is just so pretty, and this is going to blow your mind. The player on piano, Joey Alexander, is all of 11 years old when he played that, and he's from Bali. On bass, Larry Grenadier, the famed U.S. bassist, and both together performing My Favorite Things, a title track on Joey's debut album released in May just last year. Again, he released his first album at the age of 11, obviously influenced by U.S. jazz greats. Joey taught himself to play jazz at the age of 6 and is considered a child prodigy. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and my Lord, I had to catch myself over the weekend. I don't know. I mean, so much was going on. It almost got lost in the shuffle. Sister Hillary and Brother Bernie, both at the Black Church. Bernie might have thought that he snagged an appearance. He thought he clinched it at Victory Missionary Baptist Church in Las Vegas ahead of the February 20th primary in that state. And when he got there, what did he find? He found Hillary Clinton. He found Hillary Clinton, and she was not alone. Who was with her? The civil rights icon, Representative John Lewis of Georgia, in tow, introducing Sister Hillary, who I didn't imagine she needed any introduction to Black folks, since she's so madly in love with Black folks. But he was there to introduce her just the same. It was just so incredible. What did he say? He told the congregation that the vote is the most powerful nonviolent tool in a democratic society, he said to people who know it better than he did. He says, I am here for my friend, my beloved sister, who I've known for so many years, who is a warrior, a fighter. She is prepared. She is ready. Well, of course, you know, this is incredible. And not for the reason that you think. This is standard, election stuff. People show up all the time looking for votes, trolling for votes wherever they can. But what is interesting here is the remarkable evidence that Black folks are just not safe anywhere, not even when they want to be at peace with the Lord. You have these intruders coming in into their churches, invited into what I would think would be a sacred place that should absolutely be off limits to this kind of pandering, and they have people who come in there lying to them, and they countenance it, and they are invited into Black churches. I think this thing should stop. I mean, where do you enjoy sanctity? Where do you enjoy full non-interference? People barging in, even on your own spiritual time. They come to your church, and in the case of Hillary Clinton, bearing serious lies, and with a Black ambassador. Why? Well, you know, the classic liberal irony. Here's a person who boasts all the time about her connections, her and Bill's connections to the Black community. In fact, they are one with it. You know, some of their best friends are Black people. Why do you need a Black ambassador to hold your hand to bring you to a Black church when you should be immediately recognizable and welcomed? Bernie Sanders apparently didn't need to be introduced by somebody Black, but Sister Hillary did, and she selected John Lewis. Yes. Well, this tells you, again, that we have a compounding of disrespect. And my only hope is that congregations will insist that their churches are, in fact, sanctuaries. They are not places for people to barge in. I don't care what stripes they are of politically. But when you are trying to just get your spiritual bearings recalibrated on a Sunday, and people just show up with the explicit and sole intention of proselytizing for the vote. They just want you to vote. They don't care about what happened to you 10 minutes before you walked into church. They're making a sales pitch. And these pastors, these toadies, allow people to come in and they bring their lies and their campaign garbage and dump it right there in your sanctuary and disrupt people's intention of just trying to patch up their tattered souls. And you come in with this nonsense, aided and abetted by none other than the person who's supposed to be protecting you from these things. I mean, if it is important to candidates to address a congregation, and it's an amazing thing, they know where to find these churches. They know where to find black people when they need them. They don't know how to find black people when the fecal matter is colliding with the oscillating device. They don't know how to find black folks then. But they have the attitude that they just need to show up at a couple of churches, find somebody who would bring you in, because, you know, black folks talk that kind of black talk to other black folks. Have them come in and translate black. Talk black talk. And in the case of John Lewis, just repeat a whole string of lies about Sister Hillary. Cleanse her soul before the Lord and exhort your fellow sufferers to bring their souls to the polls and cast their votes for this demon. There ought to be a stop to that. What I imagine one day, a dream of mine, is that when these things happen at a black church, in unison, people should just get up and walk out, or stand up and turn their backs, and the next Sunday demand a vote to remove the pastor or whoever was responsible for that insult, to have people brought into their churches for the sole purpose of preaching at them a whole set of lies as to why they should be voted for, talking to people in condescending tones and lying to them about their records and about who they are and about why they ought to be supported. It ought to stop. I don't know any other congregation that would permit this kind of insult to their congregations during a service that they would just have basically sales pitches occurring at a time when people are trying to just reconnect with their spiritual selves. Black folks are just not safe anywhere, and they're likely to be sold out by everyone. It was incredible. This happened on Sunday, but just Thursday, the husband of Hillary Clinton decided that, people need to have he's going to teach us a whole lesson about brotherhood, true brotherhood, and true racial identity. He is going to tell us what it's all about. And what does he say? He tells a group, he's of course helping Hillary mine the black vote, and he presumes to tell people, he says, What did they learn so far from their campaigning efforts and so forth? What had they learned with the appointment of Barack Obama? It's not enough to say that he's the first black president. Bill Clinton says we should regard him as the first mixed race president. And here's what he says. You know what else we learned about the human genome, he says. He said that among the things that they learned from the Barack Obama election as president, we learned that unless your ancestors, every one of you, are 100%, 100% from sub-Saharan Africa, we are all mixed race people. Well, amen. What are you going to do with this? I mean, what kind of an asinine mindset is this? Where did he get this from? But very nonchalantly assumes full authority and power to redefine genetics and history and geography all at the same time. What are you going to do with people like this? I tell you. Well, you know, this is for openers, but what I want to do, because, as you know, Judge Antonin Scalia died on Saturday, allegedly of natural causes, and it began immediately a frenzied hunt and a frenzied demand by people on all political sides of the spectrum to have a replacement. And of course, it's a very significant thing. How the press treated this is a whole subject for discussion. We'll get into that later on in the week. But the push for President Obama to appoint and replace the right-leaning constitutional originalist is on. And that is going to be where we're going today. What is this business of constitutional originalism? Judge Scalia, we'll talk about him in greater detail tomorrow with our dear friend, Gerald Horn, Dr. Gerald Horn. But the theory that is postulated all the time when his name is mentioned is that he's a strict constitutional originalist. And this is a kind, I mean, people invent all these kinds of terms and all these ways of trying to distract from the central question, and that is the validity of the Constitution itself, and therefore everything that derives from the Constitution. So to validate, in some quarters, they validate the ideological leanings of members of the U.S. Supreme Court by selecting to define their political ideology. And in the case of Scalia, it is that he is a strict constitutional originalist, as opposed to being a member of the school that the Constitution is a what they widely refer to as a living document. That is, it's a point of reference, but it is to be understood that it evolves, its meaning and its original intent, hence the word originalist, its original intent, therefore, cannot be seen as fixed, but as constantly evolving and therefore worthy of reinterpretation. But that was not the school of thought of Scalia. Scalia was referred to and is widely recognized still as a constitutional originalist. Tomorrow we will get into the details of how that influenced some of his opinions. But what we need to know is that the U.S. Supreme Court, which wrongly is lifted up before the people as this bastion of what should I say, neutrality, that they operate within a kind of vacuum. They do not, their views are not politically informed or politically motivated. And that's a lot of hogwash. And the fight now to replace Scalia is proof positive that people recognize what has been true for a very long time. The U.S. Supreme Court is not some entity that concentrates strictly on the scholarship of law. It does not have a purity about it. What happens is that there is a great deal of politicization of the U.S. Supreme Court, and especially so in recent years. So I thought we should get a background on this question because it will inform a lot of the discussion going along now as this matter is discussed with heated passion. Who is going to be the replacement for Scalia, and what would the ideological makeup of the Supreme Court be? How would that affect opinions, et cetera, et cetera? Here is John Friedel. He's a professor of political science at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. And he gives a very interesting overview of this matter of constitutional originalism. And he says, in fact, to assume that the U.S. Supreme Court is immune to politics and the politicization that we are witnessing now is, in fact, to embrace a huge myth. Here is Professor John Friedel. It's a long enough clip, but it is instructive, and it should serve as the basis of our understanding of where we will be going in the coming days with this discussion.
Looking Glass, which was Lewis Carroll's follow-up to Alice in Wonderland. Humpty Dumpty says, "When I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." "The question is," said Alice, "whether you can make words mean so many different things." "The question is," said Humpty Dumpty, "which is to be master? That is all." As you may have gathered from this quote and from the title for my talk this evening, I believe that the Constitution of the United States means what five justices of the United States Supreme Court choose it to mean, neither more nor less. And I believe this is true no matter what the political makeup of the court may be. It is as true of conservatives as it is of liberals, Republicans or Democrats. What you may not have gathered from the quote and from the title of my talk is that I do not believe this is a bad thing, or that it is anything different from what the framers of the Constitution envisioned would happen. I believe it is a fact of life in our society, and that for the most part, it serves us well. Before continuing on this subject, I'd like to take a quick poll, if I may. In the 2000 presidential election in Florida, after the initial vote count, Governor George W. Bush was ahead by 1,784 votes. After some legal wrangling, the United States Supreme Court ordered a halt to the recounting of votes, which meant that any chance that Vice President Al Gore might have had to become president was ended. Now for the poll. Raise your hand if you think that the ruling would have gone the same way if Al Gore had been ahead by 1,784 votes. That is, would the Supreme Court have allowed the recount to continue if George W. Bush had been behind in the vote count, thereby guaranteeing Mr. Gore the presidency? Let's see your hand. Two. Okay. Three. Four. Okay. Keep this question in mind because I'm going to come back to it at the end of my talk tonight. Also, before I go on with my talk, let's get the elephant out of the closet, or maybe I should say let's get the donkey out of the closet. On many social issues, social policy matters, I tend to take positions that most people would think of as liberal. When I was living in Michigan and practicing law there, I was a member of the state ACLU Lawyers Committee, the group that decided what cases to take on representation and what positions to adopt in litigation. So you might expect me to be hypercritical of many of the decisions handed down by what has become in recent years an increasingly conservative Supreme Court. But that's not what I want to talk about tonight, because although I may disagree with some of those decisions, I don't believe the system is broken. On the contrary, I think it's working just fine, and just as the framers of the Constitution hoped it would. In my brief remarks tonight, let me tell you why I think that's the case. I start with the premise that the U.S. Supreme Court is a political institution. The fact that the justices on the court are appointed rather than elected does not make it any less political. Appointment to the Supreme Court is not a matter of how well one did in law school or how many law review articles one published, but rather positions that one has taken on important social and political issues that matter to the president making the appointment and to the Senate confirming it. I believe it is necessary to identify the court as a political institution because it follows that the decisions made by the court or by a majority of the justices on the court are political in nature. It would be a different world if our Constitution were so clear and so complete in every detail that the original intent of the framers were susceptible of only one interpretation. Then virtually every decision of the court would be unanimous, and politics would never enter into the picture. But we all know that not to be the case. So, if the original intent of the framers of the Constitution is to be carried out in the decisions of the Supreme Court, then there are at least two different different possible conclusions we can draw from the fractured opinions that are so common today. One is that the original intent is clear, and that at least four and sometimes five members of the Supreme Court purposely choose to ignore the original intent in order to achieve their own personal political agenda. As I hope to illustrate by my comments tonight, that is highly unlikely. A second possible interpretation is that the original intent is unclear, and that those members of the court and others who are unhappy with a particular decision invoke the doctrine of original intent to criticize the decision and the majority who handed it down. But that is a political argument, not a jurisprudential one. For this reason, it is my position that the Constitution should be interpreted as a living document, and that while the original language of the framers who drafted the Constitution should be taken into consideration, we should seek to apply the underlying constitutional principles they created to the world in which we live. First, we must recognize that with very few exceptions, we can't know the original intent of the framers. The best record we have of the debates at the Constitutional Convention come from James Madison's diary, which was not a stenographic record, but reflected Madison's own interests and interpretations. Late in his life, Madison wrote in a letter to a colleague that, and I'm quoting here, "the debates and incidental decisions of the convention can have no authoritative character." We do have the Federalist Papers, which were written by several members of the Constitutional Convention and advocated positions taken by some of the framers. But those positions were not uniformly adopted in the text of the Constitution, and some were opposed by a majority of the signers of the Constitution. Nor can we always rely on a literal interpretation of the language used in the Constitution, because at least in some cases the framers got it wrong. For example, in both Article 3, Section 2, and in the Sixth Amendment, the Constitution says, In all criminal cases, the accused shall have the right to a trial by jury. Yet in 1789, the standard practice was to grant a jury trial only in cases where the accused could be sentenced to a lengthy prison term. And even today, those accused of a misdemeanor are not entitled to a trial by jury in some states for offenses punishable by less than 6 months in jail. In the case of the Double Jeopardy Clause in the Fifth Amendment, the actual language says, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. But in 1789, one could be put in jeopardy of life or liberty, but not of limb. And even today, that remains true. If someone is convicted of a crime, they can be imprisoned or executed, but they can't have an arm or a leg amputated, which would then, as now, violate the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. So how are we to carry out the original intent of the framers, yet adhere to a literal application of their words? I have no problem with the Supreme Court choosing to ignore the literal meaning of the words in the Constitution if they don't make sense in our modern society. But if we do that, then let's recognize that the court's decisions in several recent cases are not based on original intent, as suggested by some members of the court, but on the views of a majority of the justices. In considering the Constitution as a living document, we seek to apply the principles of the Constitution to our modern world, taking into account changes that have occurred since the Constitution or the amendment in question was ratified. Let's look at a few constitutional principles to see why this should be the case. I've chosen three amendments to the Constitution to illustrate this position, the Second, the Ninth, and the 14th. The Second Amendment reads as follows. I probably don't need to tell you what the Second Amendment says. I'm in West Virginia. You all know this, probably have it tattooed on you. But here it goes. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. What was the original intent behind this amendment? Since we have no complete, accurate record of the debates at the Constitutional Convention, we have to rely on the language of the Constitution and the historical context in which it was drafted. The amendment clearly seems to link the right to keep and bear arms to the need for a well-regulated militia. Could the framers have simply said, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed? Of course they could have. The fact that they included the language about the need for a militia to maintain the security of a free state cannot be ignored or cast aside as merely superfluous wording. So let's consider what it meant in 1791 when the Second Amendment was ratified. At that time, the weapon of choice was a breech-loading rifle. With such a rifle, you could shoot and kill one person, then reload, taking maybe 30 seconds, and fire again. They had larger weapons of mass destruction, like cannons. And from the vagueness of the amendment, we might assume that the right to keep and bear a cannon was also protected. Okay. Now, what is a militia? The dictionary defines it as an army composed of citizens rather than professional soldiers called out in time of emergency. In 1776, the United States did not have a standing army, and the Revolutionary War was fought by militiamen assembled from the various colonies. Each member brought his own weapon. After the war was over, the army largely disbanded, with the citizen soldiers taking their weapons home. The concern of the framers seems to have been that the government should not disarm the citizens because they needed their arms in order to defend their country and their state in times of war or domestic upheaval. Also, having just staged a rebellion against a tyrannical government, they wanted to preserve the threat of a popular anti-government uprising as a check against further future tyranny. In 2011, we have no militia. The need has simply disappeared. Also, in 2011, we have a society riddled with violent crime, much of it associated with handguns. So if the Second Amendment relates the right to keep and bear arms to the need for an army composed of citizens rather than professional soldiers, it seems irrelevant. Wars are fought today with weapons that private citizens would not keep or bear. And handguns are certainly not the weapon of choice for almost any military encounter. If we take the language of the Second Amendment literally, then each citizen should be permitted to keep and bear any weapon he or she chooses. Say, a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, which would come in handy if a hijacked airplane was being flown into your house or your office. The Supreme Court, in the last 3 years, has struck down laws prohibiting the possession of handguns and certain other types of small arms at both the federal and state levels. The grounds for those decisions, both decided by a 5-4 majority in the Supreme Court, the grounds for those decisions were that the Second Amendment protects the right of the individual to keep a handgun. They are not based on the need for an army of private citizens called up in times of emergency. The framers of the Constitution could have said that's what they intended, but instead they chose to use language relating the right to the need for a militia. I would suggest to you that these two decisions involving the right to own and carry a handgun are examples of judicial activism by a court seeking to impose its own political and social views in place of the decisions made by duly elected officials representing the voters of the District of Columbia in the first case and the City of Chicago in the second case. I'm not saying that the outcomes were bad. I own a gun. I don't want anybody to take it away from me. I think it's a good result. What I'm saying is that the decision should not be interpreted, as their authors claim, as somehow divining the original intent of the framers of the Constitution. If the court had sought to follow the doctrine of original intent and to respect the principle of federalism and of states' rights, it would have deferred to the elected legislative bodies who passed those ordinances. Surely there is language in the Second Amendment that would permit such a deferential interpretation. Four of the nine justices had no trouble finding such language. On the other hand, another way to approach this question. Gun ownership by private individuals is a long-standing tradition in the United States, a commonly accepted practice dating back centuries. If the court wished to preserve a constitutional right of the individual to own a handgun, then it could have done so by resorting not to the Second Amendment, which talks about a militia, but to the Ninth Amendment, which talks about preserving those rights not specifically enumerated in the Constitution, and therefore not ignoring or disregarding that prefatory clause in the Second Amendment that ties gun rights to the need for a militia. Justice Scalia, who wrote the majority opinion in Heller, the D.C. case, and who joined the majority in McDonald's, the Chicago case, is one of the most outspoken proponents of the doctrine of original intent. He often says that if we don't think the framers' views apply to our modern world, we have a remedy written into the Constitution that allows us to amend it. If he were true to his position, he would, in my view, uphold the laws of the District of Columbia and Chicago and recommend a constitutional amendment that creates the right of private citizens at both the state and the federal level to keep and bear small arms outside the context of a well-regulated militia. That would put the question back in the legislative branch of government, which is where it belongs. But the majority recognized the true nature of the problem with this approach. Amending the Constitution is difficult. It's cumbersome, and it's not at all certain. In contrast, what is certain is that a 5-member majority that declares gun ownership a constitutional right under the Second Amendment, it becomes the law of the land. You don't need to amend the Constitution then. So principles give way to pragmatism. Conservative judicial activism is cloaked in the mantle of original intent jurisprudence, and the debate goes on. Next, let's look briefly at the 14th Amendment to see how the Constitution of a, how the concept of a living Constitution applies. In 1866, right after the Civil War, Congress passed a Civil Rights Act making all persons born in the United States citizens of the United States. Until then, they weren't. Then, to protect against the Supreme Court declaring the Civil Rights Act of 1866 unconstitutional, which was a distinct possibility because the Supreme Court in 1857 had declared that certain people born in the United States were not citizens. So they were worried about whether the Supreme Court would declare that act unconstitutional, and to prevent a future Congress from repealing the Civil Rights Act altogether by a mere majority vote, Congress proposed the 14th Amendment. And 2 years later, in 1868, it was ratified by the required 3/4 of the states. Was the original intent of Congress following the Civil War to give slaves emancipated by the 13th Amendment equal rights under the law, or more broadly, equal social status throughout society? Did they envision a fully integrated society, or just a society in which freed slaves and their former masters would coexist as legal equals? Did they envision the 14th Amendment as granting to former slaves the right to own property, or the right to own property in an all-white neighborhood? The right to attend public schools, or the right to attend integrated public schools? Whichever way you look at it, whichever view you take regarding the original intent of the 14th Amendment, the Supreme Court got it wrong at least once. In 1896, in Plessy versus Ferguson, the court held that separate but equal train cars met the requirement of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, saying that as long as blacks could ride in the same quality train car, that was all that was required. But in 1954, in Brown versus Board of Education, the court held that separate could never be equal and that segregated schools were by their very nature unequal and violated the Equal Protection Clause. So, did the Warren Court get it wrong? Did the drafters of the 14th Amendment and the state legislators who collectively ratified it in 1868 truly envision integrated schools? Or did the social circumstances in the United States change dramatically over the century following the Civil War, such that the country could now conceive of an integrated society that would have been impossible in 1868? If we take an original intent approach to constitutional interpretation, Brown versus Board of Education got it wrong. And we need to go back and amend the Constitution further to say that the Equal Protection Clause means that no separate schools or segregated public accommodations, such as hotels, theaters, restaurants, and public transportation, will be permitted. Not to mention the rights of African Americans to live in previously all-white neighborhoods. That interpretation would square with the intent of Congress in 1868, when no one, certainly not a majority of those who voted for ratification, could have foreseen that full racial integration of the South would occur in their lifetimes. Keep in mind that in 1868, even the Northern schools were segregated. It's only when we see the Constitution as a living document that we're able to move beyond the social context in which the words were originally written. Note also that Brown versus Board of Education can be seen as an example of judicial activism by a liberal court that imposed its own viewpoint, overturning not only a policy enacted by a duly elected legislative body, but also a long-standing Supreme Court precedent. The court's decision in Plessy versus Ferguson still stood, and the segregation of schools was the official policy of the Topeka, Kansas School Board. In order to reach the result that the court reached in Brown versus Board of Education, it had to determine that the school board policy was unconstitutional because it deprived some citizens of their rights, even though it's far from clear that those rights as defined in 1954 were the same rights that were intended in 1868. Now, you could say the same thing about the court's decision in Second Amendment cases. In order for the court to reach the decision it reached, it had to determine that the legislature's decision to ban handguns was unconstitutional because it deprived some citizens of their rights, even though it is far from clear that those rights defined in 2009 and 2010 in those decisions were the same rights that were intended in 1791. If one case is an example of judicial activism, then so is the other. If Brown versus Board of Education is not an original intent decision, then neither is Heller versus District of Columbia or McDonald versus Chicago, the gun control cases. Okay, finally, let's take a look at the Ninth Amendment, which reads as follows. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. I'll read it again. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. That's all it says. Nothing more specific than that. Doesn't the Ninth Amendment require judicial activism? How are we to determine whether a right not enumerated in the Constitution, not part of that original language, is really a right worthy of protection? And how do we decide the argument between a state or local government acting on the basis of power to provide for the welfare of its citizens, reserved to the states under the Constitution, and the claim of an individual to a right that is being abused by the state? Suppose we say that the framers really did intend for all unenumerated rights to be retained by the people. That would seem to suggest that those rights cannot be taken away by the states. What are some of those rights? The right to marry the person of one's choice? Seems like a good one. The right to educate one's children in the manner one chooses? That seems like a good right. The right to privacy? I like that. How do we decide which ones are of sufficient import to fit the definition of original intent and which are less important to the extent that we're willing to uphold state laws that restrict them? Well, the Supreme Court has had some difficulty in this area, and its decisions have been inconsistent and highly criticized. As to the right to educate one's children, the Supreme Court has said that states can regulate education, but it has imposed some limitations on what a state can do. For example, a state can't prohibit the teaching of a foreign language. That's Meyer versus Nebraska, 1925, I think. A state can't require that all parents send their children to public schools. That's Pierce versus Society of Sisters in Oregon. And it can't require Amish parents to keep their children in school beyond the eighth grade. That's Wisconsin versus Yoder. With regard to the right to marry, the court has said that a state law prohibiting interracial marriage is unconstitutional. Imagine how the framers would have thought of that decision, some of whom owned slaves. Clearly, the concept of choosing a spouse is not an enumerated right in the Constitution. You won't find it anywhere in the Bill of Rights where it says you can marry the person of your choice. But if it's okay to marry a person of a different race, is it also okay to marry a person of the same gender? The court has already said that it's okay to have sexual relations with a person of the same gender, striking down a Texas law against sodomy in the case of Lawrence versus Texas on the grounds that it violated the constitutional right to privacy. Not sure what the original intent of the framers would have been on that case. But the right to privacy is not an enumerated right in the Constitution. Was that decision in Lawrence versus Texas an example of judicial activism? If it was, then so too was the decision in Griswold versus Connecticut, in which the court struck down a law prohibiting the use or counseling in the use of contraceptives. If you don't agree that homosexuals should have the right to engage in consensual sex, then it's tough to argue that heterosexuals should have the right to engage in protected consensual sex, at least in Connecticut in 1965 when there was a law against using contraceptives. If privacy is a civil liberty that we enjoy under the Ninth Amendment, then what one does in one's bedroom should be among the most private aspects of one's life. It seems clear that if they had thought about it and they had deemed it important, the framers of the Constitution could have inserted into the First Amendment a few choice words adding the right of privacy to the other enumerated rights, such as free speech and free exercise of religion. Does the absence of those words to the advocate of original intent mean that the framers did not intend to protect individual privacy, and that if we want to do so, we must amend the Constitution? Well, that was the argument in the dissent in Griswold versus Connecticut that was voiced by Justice Hugo Black. He would have upheld the Connecticut law, which he called silly, and allowed the banning of birth control in Connecticut because he could find nothing in the Constitution that protected the right of privacy, and he argued that the only solution was a constitutional amendment. Think about this position for a minute. What's the logical conclusion of Justice Black's dissenting view? If he's correct, then what does the Ninth Amendment mean? Is it just a hollow collection of meaningless words? If there's no right of privacy retained by the people without an explicit constitutional amendment, then what rights does the Ninth Amendment refer to? If privacy is not an unenumerated right, what is? I would submit to you that if for no other reason than that, the Ninth Amendment is the strongest argument against the original intent approach to constitutional interpretation. It cries out for interpreting the Constitution as a living document, one that must be interpreted in keeping with the times. This doesn't mean that judges should readily create new law or reinterpret existing law by overturning legal precedent, but it does mean to me that the framers recognized that if the Constitution were to remain vibrant as a guiding set of legal principles for our nation, then it had to remain flexible. The amendment process that they created works to do that, but only to a limited extent, because the amendment process is difficult and cumbersome, and it creates a significant barrier by requiring 3/4 of the state legislatures to vote to ratify an amendment. The framers also were well aware of the dangers of the majority trampling on the rights of the minority, as witnessed by the protections built into the Bill of Rights. They used vague language and broad guidelines to ensure that the Constitution they created in 1789 would survive in a world beyond their ability to imagine. Earlier, I said that the Supreme Court is inherently political. Let me give you an example to illustrate why I believe this is so. This is a noisy slide, so I'm going to spend a little time explaining what's behind it. In the 1980s, the U.S. Department of Education provided funds for remedial education for disadvantaged children. New York City was using some of this money to pay public school teachers to go into private religious schools as tutors after regular school hours. In 1985, the Supreme Court, in the case of Aguilar versus Felton, which is on the left side of the screen, declared this practice unconstitutional. This, the court said, was a violation of the establishment clause.
You're listening to Professor John Friedel, professor of political science at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, giving a backgrounder on the U.S. Supreme Court, dispelling the myth, the popular myth, especially in the wake of Justice Antonin Scalia's death, that Scalia, a well-known proponent of constitutional originalism, that is, the literal interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, but with the added proviso that it reflect the thinking of the framers at the time. Now, what's going to be very important about this discussion is that it serves two purposes. One, it gives us a point of reference about the fight that is about to break out over the appointment of his replacement, if there's going to be an appointment of a replacement before President Obama leaves office. But more importantly, it addresses the ideological thinking across the board of the members, the nine justices comprising the U.S. Supreme Court. It questions what exactly informs their decision. And I might add on top of that, that for those of us who like history and are concerned about history, you no doubt paid attention to the fact that the vast majority of the cases cited by Professor Friedel today happened to involve people of African ancestry in the United States. The document itself, the U.S. Constitution, reflecting the views and the proclivities of the white power structure, the white elitist and supremacist power structure. And therefore, we have to interpret this concept of constitutional originalism also as the ongoing effort to reinforce and to continue that ideological bent in the ways that the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings have helped shape our society since the foundation and the founding of this country. It's a very important backdrop to appreciate because we will be coming back to it time and again. This period of time affords us the opportunity to revisit this discussion from any number of perspectives, but this is particularly important to understand. Stay tuned. Coming up next is the Global Research News Hour. You want to stay tuned for that. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and let me know what you think of this program. Tomorrow, as I said, Gerald Horn, and we will continue some of our discussion from today because there will be developments to report tomorrow. Please do tell people about PRN.FM and about this program, hopefully one of your favorites. And I thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks again. Bye-bye.